Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that cuts through the noise of the communications industry and gets straight to the good stuff. Hosted by Becca, a no BS corporate comms expert, and Perry, a PR agency founder with a knack for telling it like it is. This show is where strategy meets straight talk. From media relations and brand storytelling to navigating the chaos of modern PR, they're bringing unfiltered insights, industry truths, and an occasional spicy take. Whether you're an industry pro, a curious marketer, or just here for the raw and real, you're in the right place. No fluff, no spin, no corporate jargon, just Under Embargo. Now let's get into it.
Wow. Hey, Becca, what are you doing here? This is weird.
I am so excited that we're here together on this screen, almost like we're together in real life.
It's almost like we're in real life. And I think what we're doing here is kicking off the inaugural podcast of Under Embargo that you and I are collaborating on to basically take by storm the entire communications industry.
Yes. And why the hell are we doing that?
Because I think philosophically we're kind of aligned that the world is full of BS and we're trying to cut through some of that and to help elevate professionals like you and me to be able to get that seat at the boardroom table and to not have to bullshit their way there.
Or you can bullshit your way there and have the skills and all of the experience also to get you there. But also you bring the agency side and I bring the corporate in-house side. So I think we bring a nice dynamic of kind of the full communications picture. Please don't just call it PR.
Yeah, exactly right. This is 360, man. This is the whole enchilada you get with us, which is fantastic. And we don't work together. We're not competing against each other. So we can talk in real terms. Like, you're not going to take my job or my clients. I'm not going to take your job or your client. So it's fantastic. We can say what we really think and not have to worry about, you know, burning bridges or saying the wrong thing.
Totally. I mean, and we like know each other. We don't really know each other. I've just been online stalking you for the past couple of years. And I don't know. So this is a good way for us to really get to know each other, I guess, on camera. So other people can see us getting to know each other.
We're building a relationship in real time, Becca, in real time.
Which is in public, in real time.
In public, which is what I've done on LinkedIn for the past 4 years. Built my agency, which is a tech PR agency, in the cold, hard light of day by sharing the good, the bad, the ugly about everything that I'm doing. And I know you are kind of similar in the sense that you're not confined to a topic. You kind of lay it all out there.
I mean, yes, correct. Authenticity is the name of the game. I don't really know how to filter it down to a topic. It's just whatever pops into my head at any given time. But you actually brought up a good segue, which is, how did you start your own agency? Because I feel like if we're going to do a podcast, we need to have a little bit of origin story in here.
All right. Well, I think that's fair. And I'm going to ask the same of you so that the viewers and listeners get a chance to understand kind of who we are and what brought us to this fateful day. Yeah. My story is a little atypical. I think a lot of people go to college. They either study liberal arts or journalism or comms and then just kind of start a PR career. My background is much, much, much different. I was not very good in school. I actually came from a broken home, multiple divorces, and I was kind of a rebellious, rambunctious, ne'er-do-well, kicked out of high school three times, and I never made it past the eighth grade. So that was kind of how it started. But then circumlocutiously, I ended up doing a lot of different things that got me to a community college. And from there, I actually was recruited to work on the school newspaper because I won an English composition writing award, which is kind of crazy considering I didn't make it past eighth grade. And then within a year, I was named editor-in-chief of that newspaper. Which was shocking to everyone that knows me, like, holy crap, you might make it someday, kid. And there I won a national writing award. It's kind of the Pulitzer writing award for colleges. Wow. I wrote a series of stories about the English as a second language program at my school. And as a result, it went into a national competition and I won a huge award that got me into Boston University. So I ended up graduating from college. And then I did study journalism there and I studied liberal arts and got a job as a reporter out of the gate.
At BU, did you say Boston University?
Boston University, that's right.
A great journalism school, right?
They do. And I wrote for the school paper, but I also worked full time while I was going there. So I worked at the Lowell Sun full time, going to school at BU full time, where I was a general assignment reporter there. And then a long, long kind of story, but I got disillusioned with the journalism world at the paper I was at because it was a little too sensational. Like, for example, I wrote a series of stories about a kid who was exposed to toxic chemicals. And the editor took it upon himself to put the headline, "Toxic Boy's Illness Still a Mystery," in quotation marks, on my story. And I, no one had said toxic boy. No one had quoted that. And that was kind of the first of many things that got me thinking, maybe this particular paper isn't for me. So I eventually parlayed my journalism skills into the next best thing at the time, which was PR, because you could still write, you could still communicate. And that's kind of how I got into PR. So I'm going to pause there because that's a whole lot of information. And before we move on, I'll let you ask any questions, but if not, I want to hear how you got into PR, not how you got to where you are today.
So, you know, it's funny because I have a very same, but different background, which is I was terrible in school and, people had high expectations of me and I always under-delivered for everybody all the time. But I came from a very loving home where I was given all of the opportunities. I went to a school for gifted kids. Always felt like an idiot, like fully, there is something wrong with me. Why am I so stupid? Teachers, every single report card, whatever, was, if Becca would just, she has so much potential, you know, she could stop distracting her. Did I do that? It's talking at me.
I think I hit my watch and something happened. I don't know. Sorry.
That's wild. But it did it on my screen. Anyway, whatever. I always often make hand motions come up.
Your screen is like, you can't do this, Becca. No.
No, don't stop talking. Earlier I did it and balloons came up when I was talking to somebody. It was very awkward. Anyway, so I grew up in the Bay Area and I was grew up around really smart people and I didn't understand that I was, you know, a fish in a big pool of fishes. And so I really thought I was stupid. And then I went to college, I went to USC, I went to grad school. I did all of these things that are very high achieving things, entirely thinking I was dumb. Went to USC, had a great communication school, and I picked comms because my roommate was studying comms. And then there was this great, I went on Semester at Sea, which I don't know if you've heard of Semester at Sea. You go on a boat around the world, you circumnavigate the globe and stop at countries. You stud again with it. I need to turn off my finger things. You circumnavigate the globe and you stop in various countries. You study all of the countries and then you stop in them. And we left from Canada, Vancouver, Canada, and we were going to Seoul, South Korea. And we got trapped on a ship in the middle of three hurricane systems in the North Pacific Ocean. So it was like very, very cold.
Three hurricane systems?
Only three. Yeah. Wow. And we didn't know it. So we had a full week of like really bad storms. Like everyone was motion sick. I was not. I was one of the few people that wasn't vomiting everywhere. But it was like just a disaster. You couldn't go outside. We were stuck inside you couldn't even really sit at a table because everything was just like flip-flopping everywhere. And then one night, nobody was sleeping because our beds were literally like ripped off the walls, like just moving in our rooms. Like it was so unsafe. And then one night, basically we heard a crash. Like you hear this loud noise and then breathless person comes over the loudspeaker. Everyone needs to get into the hallways. And it was just this like, what the hell is going on? It turns out we had been hit by what is called a rogue wave, which is like we thought 50 foot, they later estimated it to be 80 foot wave that crashed through the bridge of our ship disabled the engines. Like all of the electronics got disabled. And so we became a sitting duck. So we didn't have any motor control. We just sat there in the middle of these like massive waves just rolling. And there's video of it that I've posted before. And I'm happy to share with people if anybody wants to see, because the Coast Guard came and they're just above us. Like we can't do anything. Look at them. And there's video of them just watching us. Anyway, the long story short is we all survived. But I had a satellite phone because my parents were like, we're not going to send our daughter around the world on a boat without some way to get a hold of her. I have Jewish parents. It's like part of that comes with the territory. And only like six of us on the ship had one. So the captain was like, does anyone have a satellite phone? Because our communications don't work anymore. So I became one of the only people who had communications, and the news media got a hold of that. They got a hold of my mom first. She was on the Today Show with Lester Holt, who's like now super famous. And then I was interviewed, and then the AP picked us up in Hawaii, which is where we ended up getting kind of stranded to. And the rest is history. I was like, this is the best, coolest thing ever. I want to do this. And I didn't want to be a journalist. I wanted to be kind of like part of the machine that was telling the stories. So that, you know,
that's amazing. And I'm gonna tell you, that's a much more interesting story than mine.
I don't know. It's just different.
You mentioned Lester Holt. I believe he just stepped down today from his post at CBS or NBC, wherever
NBC,
he is.
I think.
Today he stepped down as part of like the massive media shakeup that's happening everywhere. Joy Reid stepped down, Lester Holt, Jim Acosta, like all these guys are stepping down. Anyway, that is a crazy, 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 crazy story. So then what happened next? Like, how did you parlay that into the comms world?
So then I went back to college and was like, I know what I want to do. I want to do something, right? I finally was like, I have an ambition. So I asked a professor, like, what do I do for a job? And he's like, I can introduce you to somebody at a PR agency. And so he did. And then I went to this PR agency and I worked in sports PR, which was so fun. But I was like, I cannot do this for more than a little while. Yeah. Back to grad school.
I wish I could say I had some like noble intention getting into PR. I just wanted to not be a part of the problem with media, number one. And number two, I wanted to make money. I was like, how do I make the most money?
You thought PR was going to be your moneymaker?
I'm not wrong. I mean, ultimately, it turned out pretty well. But, I'll put it this way. If I had stayed in journalism proper, I would have had to go from my GA, general assignment reporter job at a mid-sized daily, to then go to like the Hartford Current or the Boston Globe. And I'd have to work at night chasing ambulances around for like 3 or 4 years to earn my keep, to make a decent salary. And I would say within 2 years, I probably eclipsed in PR what I would have made as a journalist. And I never looked back. So I definitely think from a lucrative standpoint, this was far better. And importantly, it was just more like structured and more like definite, instead of just not knowing where you're going to be, what you're going to be covering, what gruesome roadside spectacle you're going to have to write about or see.
Think that you could have been fired with Jim Acosta, though. I mean, you've missed out on the opportunity.
Right. I could have started a podcast with Jim. We would have called it Rogue Wave.
Damn, missed opportunity. Rogue Wave. That's what I'm going to call my biography. Yeah. Well, so carry on. You got into PR, but now you own an agency. That's different than, working at an agency.
You're not wrong. That is different. So what happened was I was an account executive at a firm called Sterling Hager in Boston. It was a mid-sized agency. There were probably, 70-ish people at that time, growing like crazy. It was right after the go-go 90s. And I did a good job. I was able to get a lot of media coverage really, really quickly. So in those days, we picked up the phone and just like called.
Oh, I remember.
Appointments, and we would do competitions where who can get the most, book the most appointments for your client.
It was a sales job, right? You're doing cold calls.
Yes, it was. And I was like the wolf of Wall Street back then.
I hated it so much.
Up those appointments. So and every time a client had like a minor like product launch or something, I'd book 25 appointments, a full blown analyst tour, and the whole thing. And so that was the premium in that job back then was can you get media? Can you get media? And I could. And around that time, they decided to open up a San Francisco office, and they were looking for people to go start it. I had nothing tethering me to the East Coast. So I said, sure, why not? And they flew me out, paid for everything to get me out there. And that was in 2000. And I was out there for the next 11 years growing.
That's a weird time to move to the Bay Area, 2000.
Yeah, it was. It was right before the
crash, the bubble burst.
the bubble burst, the Twin Towers got blown up by airplanes. It was just a very, very strange, strange time to be there. And there was money being thrown around like crazy. My first client out there was $40,000 a month back then.
Wow.
Which is a pretty significant.
Who was it? Can you say?
It was a client called Upshot that competed directly. It was actually before Salesforce.com and Mark Benioff competed with Salesforce.com. And ultimately, they lost. And by lost, I mean they were acquired by Siebel Systems.
Siebel. I was going to say Siebel was the other one. Yeah. Yeah.
They were acquired by Siebel. And then Salesforce went on to go destroy like the world in a positive way.
Eat the world.
But yeah, I was right in the middle of that whole, you know, dogfight between all these fledgling Salesforce automation / CRM systems. And some of my earliest clients were Google and Bing. And, you know, I was right there in the middle of all that for a lot of years. And I worked my way through the downturn. So, you know, there are a lot of people that got laid off during that time, as you probably recall. And my ability to work the phones was really coming in handy because I was dialing and smiling, talking to all these Silicon Valley companies, offering them what was called a free PR fitness test. Don't hang up. If you just hang with me, we'll give you a free PR fitness test.
Wow. We'll evaluate
everything you're doing. We'll give you recommendations and all that stuff. And some percentage of those people took the bait, took the presentation, and we'd close like one out of 15 of those things, just enough to stay afloat. So I worked my way from there to becoming VP marketing for the company because I had kind of earned my stripes and did what was necessary to keep the thing afloat. So that's how I got into sort of the C-suite of PR. And then during the downturn, during the COVID pandemic, your question was, how did I start my own agency?
Yes.
During the pandemic, everybody was staring at the walls of their houses thinking like, what in the hell am I going to do with myself now? And I just thought, you know, if I'm ever going to hang my own shingle up now, probably would be the time to get those ducks in a row while everybody's just taking a big collective breath. And I did. I started an agency during probably the worst possible time, which is when no one was spending a dime and everybody was sequestered. But that's how I started Crackle. And the idea for Crackle Communications, Crackle PR was, you know, the world was a dumpster fire at that point, right? Everything was just like riots in the streets. It was just chaos. Everything was burning, you know?
Yeah.
And the idea for Crackle, the name, was that it was kind of like the world was like just wiped out and there was this big pile of ash, but underneath the ash was a little crackle, a little glimmer of hope. And I wanted to have a company that would represent something that was positive instead of being part of the problem. And that was the idea for Crackle. And against that backdrop, the sort of true north of the company is we only want to work with companies doing demonstrably good things, like good people at good companies, full stop. We have an ironclad, no assholes policy. And that's been the true north of the company for the past 4 years, and it's working out fantastically.
You know, the no assholes policy is one of my team rules. And as soon as I take over a new team or as soon as new people join my teams, that's like, I just want everyone to know, no assholes, because there's no reason to be a dick about things, you know?
Absolutely. Clients or people, one person internal to the company that just is like a brilliant asshole, let's call them. Like, I don't care how great they are, how fantastic they are. It's a cancer that will take over everybody, right?
Totally.
So you gotta find those people early and eliminate them from the mix, whether it's a client, whether it's internal, it doesn't matter. You can't have somebody like that in your ecosystem because it'll take down the rest. I think that's...
You can't have somebody around who makes other people feel like they can't share their ideas openly, right? Because then you just, you ruin the ability to innovate and do great things. So,
I mean, that kind of leads to the other big piece of kind of, I think, why we get along so well, at least on the interwebs, and why people seem to gravitate toward what we talk about, is that we both have this like empathetic view of the world, right? It's like, you don't have to be a shrewd like maniac to succeed in life. You can actually care about people and care about things and try to put yourself in their shoes and maybe have a little respect for the people that you're pitching instead of just assuming they'll do your bidding. Like, situational awareness, emotional awareness, like all this stuff is, I think, really important. And I think I do a post. I post it like maybe once every 6 months because it just resonates every time, which is that in my 20-year PR career, it's the truly kind people that have staying power. all the jerks, all the selfish people, all the like self-involved people tend to disappear when the going gets tough, but the good people are always there.
Totally.
And I like that. I don't want that to stay the case.
Well, there is something to that, especially when you run, you know, your own agency or you run a small team or whatever. Like you said, one person can change the dynamic of a whole team for good or for bad. And you need to be able to kind of at least curate as much good around you as possible if you want to make not just high performing teams, but like live in a place that doesn't suck, I guess. Like you said, empathy, but also I like that both of us are not afraid to kind of just say the quiet part out loud or, you know, not sugarcoat necessarily the things that everyone is thinking. And we just kind of say it because why the hell not? Right.
Yeah. Being a good person doesn't mean being a pushover. And I think that there's a crucial distinction there. Right. So You're right. We will say the difficult things out loud, the things that no one wants to say. They're afraid to ruffle feathers. Like, I'm not afraid to do that, but I'm not doing it from a spirit of, you know, sort of malevolence. I'm doing it because I'm hoping to educate, and by educating, elevate my people in my profession. Like, it's
also
it's
like really our experiences, especially like yours and mine. I mean, we've got 45 years of experience under our belts or something. Like, I hope that somebody learns from that. I hope that the things that we, like the pains that we had to go through, somebody is getting some value out. I hate this notion of like, well, I had to do it, so they have to do it too. It's like, I'm
right.
Sorry.
Isn't that the worst?
It's the worst.
I cannot stand that philosophy. Yeah. It's like, I had to walk 17 miles in the snow uphill. You should too, damn it.
Yeah.
Like, what is wrong with you? Just because I had it difficult, I should want you to have it difficult?
I know.
It's crazy.
In fact, I go out of my way to help my very neurodivergent kids to like the things that were hard for me as a kid to help them navigate that, because I don't think that they should have to do something that was hard just because it was hard for me too. Like, God, it's like, yeah, it sucked for me and I recognize that. Let me make it suck less for you while still teaching you how to, you know, live in the real world.
So Becca, you brought the neurodivergent piece, which I think is important because it's just germane to who you are. And I think that's one of the many things that makes you fascinating. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you mean when you say that? Because I think there's a casual listener who may not even know what that means. And it's up to you how much you share.
It's my favorite topic. And yes, and I'm glad that you kind of reminded my ADHD ass to double click on this.
Oh, you also have ADHD. Oh, okay.
So that's me. I have ADHD and it's prevalent, as anyone who's going to follow along here will see. I think you're going to yes. Perry and Becca, the ADHD duo. We find each other, right? Neurodivergent people, those of us who are, ADHD or autistic or dyslexic or insert neuro difference here. And for listeners who may not really know what the term neurodivergent means, it really just means that your brain works in a way that is not the majority of the way that brains work. The same way that a minority of the population is left-handed, which is just a difference in their brain, a minority of the population is dyslexic, and actually way more people are dyslexic than are left-handed. Way more people have ADHD than are left-handed. And we live in a society that was, if we're going to continue with this analogy, built for right-handed people, right? And left-handed people are nowadays allowed to use left-handed scissors, and they are given the tools to live in a right-handed world. It still sucks for them, and things are still harder for them, unless they are a pitcher, right? And then that's a good thing, if I'm going to bring sports into it. But that's how I look at what I do now. I have ADHD. Some things are way harder for me than for other people. I don't live my life around those things that are harder for me. I live my life around being a left-handed pitcher, right? I lean into my strengths. And I think that's what, when I talk about being ADHD, you know, there's a lot of hard things that come with being a left-handed person in a right-handed person's world. There are a lot of really cool things about thinking differently than the majority of people, because I bring ideas to the table that other people don't. And I can think of things in ways that other people don't. And I think when I started realizing that the more I lean into my differences, the better I do in my career, the better I do in my relationships and my personal life and everything, I recognize that my ADHD is, as cheesy as it sounds, it is a gift to me. And when I had kids and I recognize in them their neurodiversity, like, it is clear that it will be a gift for them too. And it already is in some ways, but, you know, I'm here to help pave that path. And the longer you know me, the more you'll see that I mention it all the time, because I sometimes look around. You'll see I bounce around in the screen. I talk in circles. I interrupt people. I forget names. Like, it's part of who I am, but it doesn't make me bad. All of the good that comes with that is so much better than just the fact that I don't always make eye contact, you know?
Yeah, same. And I don't know that we've ever talked about this, but I have the same affliction, if you want to call it that. Obviously, look at me. I'm bouncing around. I'm interrupting. I speak quickly. You know, I'm forgetful of weird things, and, you know, same kind of spectrum, I suppose. But I wanted to bring that up because you were talking earlier about when you were growing up, you felt like you were so stupid, like, even though you were at all these gifted places and you were like, you were doing quite well, but you just never thought you were smart enough, good enough, whatever. And it was because you were either not aware of or not yet had a handle on what you were going through with your brain, right?
I mean, yes, like that. And that is my entire platform around advocacy and awareness about neurodiversity, is just this, like, why are we letting people feel stupid? Why are we letting geniuses feel stupid? And I know so many people who are just absolutely brilliant, who are falling through the cracks, or they're struggling, or they feel bad about themselves or whatever. And it's just like, I don't know. It makes me sad to see it. And the more I started talking about it, the more I heard from other people that would say things like, oh my God, thank you for saying that. You're so brave. It makes me feel so. And I'm like, you know what? It's not bravery. It's almost like self-insulation, right? Like, it's protection. If I tell you that I have ADHD, it explains away some of the things that you might judge me for. But I'm also like owning the narrative of like, there is so much good that comes from this. And why are we only talking about the bad stuff? Why are we talking about it like an affliction, right? Why are we saying it's a disorder? Why don't we reframe it? Here's a perfect thing. You touched on, I noted that I went to a school for gifted kids. When people find out that their kids are gifted, their reaction is, oh, I have a gifted kid, right? My kid is so smart. When they find out that their kid is dyslexic, they're like, oh God, oh no. It's the same thing. Like, they're both neurodivergent. They both make it harder to learn. Most kids that are gifted that have high IQs also are ADHD or have autism or are dyslexic or dysgraphic or whatever. Yeah. So I don't get, it's just it's a branding thing, really, more than anything, because gifted kids struggle as much as dyslexic kids struggle. Oftentimes it's both. And so, again, like, why are we letting all of these people feel like they're idiots when they might be the smartest people in the room? And I have one more thing to say, and then we'll shut up, because this is the hill that I die on, even though it's not Oxford commas, is if I challenged you to list the 10 most brilliant people that have existed in all of history, scientists, artists, entrepreneurs, innovators, architects, mathematicians, whatever, if you listed 10 of them, I bet you 90% of them are neurodivergent, right?
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true. Almost everyone in my life that I look up to who has had success that is outsized compared to everyone else seems to fall somewhere on that spectrum. Just brilliant, quirky as hell, had a difficult childhood, felt out of place. But look at them now, generally. I mean, they tend to be dominating their respective fields and crushing life in the best possible way if they get their handle on it.
That they find their respective field, and that's it, right? Like, that's the thing. That's the frame. And I feel like as long as you can respect that people do things in a different way and what, like, empower them to do it in the way that they, and by them, I mean all people, neurodivergent or not, and they will do their best work. And that's, I think, kind of what's been missing in society right now. It's just do it this way. Do it my way, right?
Yeah. How, I'm just curious, how have you had to kind of couch how you are in a management style with new teams? Like, how does that look like when you first start? And I don't know what you can talk about relative to your career at this point. It's a little early in the thing, because I know you have an exciting career announcement at some point. But how do you approach getting on with a new team relative to the neurodivergent piece?
Yeah, it has been it's changed a lot over time, right? Because it used to be something that I kind of brought up as a, you know, hey guys, I have ADHD, so if I don't respond to an email, please remind me, right? Like, it used to be, here's how you can accommodate me as a manager because I have ADHD, advocating for myself in that way. Yeah. Then it really turned into, I know that I do things differently. I'm going to empower all of my team to do however you want to, you know, accomplish things. We're going to go by outcomes, and we're going to do everything based on outcomes. And we're not going to do it based on hours at a computer or, you know, just how much stuff is getting done. We're going to just, how are we driving the outcomes that we're setting? And I think over time that has become kind of my mantra, and it started out, it came out of my advocacy for neurodiversity, because neurodivergent people, if you give them a goal and say, go drive this goal, I guarantee you that they will go drive the shit out of that goal. If they don't know what they're driving towards, they might not be able to do it. And I realize this, all people, especially people that I surround myself with, smart people on my team, are driven that way. So give them the outcome and let them drive it however they want. It's amazing what gets done.
That is amazing. And I'm sitting here thinking, I'll put my crackle hat on for a second.
Yes.
I'm sitting here thinking about the way I run my business. And I know you've read a lot of my posts, if not, you know, most of them. And I talk all the time about how my career has been spent tracking my every move in 15-minute increments, because the bean counters at our agencies demand that we have accountability for everything we've done. And I cannot tell you how stifling that is. For creativity, for the ability to function, for people that think, I think, the way you and I basically do, which is like, it's paralyzing. And so when I started this agency, one of the many rules that I came up with was, we're not tracking time in 15-minute increments. Mm-hmm. I care about outcomes, not outputs at all. I don't give a shit when you work, how you work, with whom you work, if you're on a lawn chair, if you're laying down flat on your stomach. I don't care what you're doing. It's the outcomes that matter. And that has been the most liberating thing of my entire life. And I'll tell you, people that are working for me, maybe there's hints of the same sort of issues for them, because they are thriving in this environment. I mean,
and thriving. If you were to go somewhere else, they would go with you. Like, I have the same affliction with my team. People are like, when you go, will you hire me? Because people want to work somewhere where it's like, they're empowered and they're also driving better outcomes than they would before, right? So they're also feeling the validation of like, look at what we're doing as a team. Look at all of this shit, instead of just like, we're doing stuff for the sake of doing stuff or because we've always done it this way. And like, as an individual with high standards for myself, there's nothing that's more defeating than somebody saying, oh yeah, go write a press release, when you know it's just an activity that you're doing for the sake of doing an activity. When it's like, for what? Why are we doing this? Just tell me why we're doing it. And then I could tell you a better way for us to do it than this. Right.
Yes.
I don't know. Yes. So
and once you take down all those barriers and let people know that we're going to be safe working together and this is okay. Yes. It's amazing how supportive they'll become of one another, because you've now become like a single unit versus little pockets of people doing tasks and recording every movement.
And you're all driving the same goals, right? And that's what it is to be a team, whether or not you're working with an agency or contractors or people who are in-house. Like, all of you need the psychological safety to be like, hey, that's a bad idea. If you're the agency and you tell me, hey, that's a bad idea, I love that, because I'm like, that means that we are in a position where the person who is paying you, you still feel okay to say, I don't think that's the best idea. Like, that is why I'm paying you, right? Like, I am paying you for that expertise. Tell me when my idea is stupid.
100%. And that dovetails into another big sort of tenet generally, is that I've learned throughout my career, hire people that are better than you are in certain areas, that are smarter than you about certain things. Because if you do that, then you've now rounded out everything that is deficient about yourself. And that's what we're looking for here. We're not trying to find people who will kowtow to what you tell them to do and just like, yes, sir, and no ma'am you to death. You want people that bring perspectives that you just don't have or can't unlock in your own brain. Like that is so important.
And nothing drives me crazier, and anyone who's worked for me knows this, when I will have a team meeting and I'll be like, you know, what do you guys think? And it's like crickets. Cause I'm like, really? Like I've been talking for 20 minutes. Like, can we have a conversation? Like, I can't stand it. And you know, sometimes people just don't have ideas, whatever, but like, I don't know. The point is for you all to be able to bring the stuff to the table and not just have a boss say, okay, you go do this, you go do this. It's like, hey, this is your domain. You know, you own social media. Tell me what is the best strategy here, and you know, go do it, go make it happen. So I don't know. We need more empowerment is like the name of the business game these days. And I think as a leader, even the higher up I go in the ranks, the more frustrated I get with empowerment issues, right? Because you feel like, okay, I should be able to make whatever decisions I want about these things. And that's just not always the case.
Yeah, no, I get that. I get that. So this is a podcast that is going to cover a lot of different territory, as the readers and listeners can glean right now. We're going to be all over the map in some cases, but we also are going to focus on things like communications, like public relations, like some basic theory, that kind of stuff. We'll have guests on that are from different pockets, internal, external, maybe some CMOs from different tech type companies. You know, we'll run the gamut. And I guess when I think about my view of the PR world right now, it's just that it has never been more difficult to succeed in an environment that is so fractured and so atomized. And we talked about this a little bit when we were writing the preamble to the show. It's like, the world is just so vastly different than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And navigating that is just wild. I was saying in a post today, like comment, that there's probably a whole lot of people in the age of AI that wish they were just a little bit older so they could just retire instead of having to learn all this new shit. Because there's a lot coming down the pike. And if you're not ready to deal with it and bring it into the fold and master it, then you're going to have a difficult time.
This is the perfect question for you then, because you own a PR agency, you run a PR agency, and you are the thing that everyone's like, AI is, you guys are going to be gone in 4 years. Literally, AI is going to take your jobs, and then what? So like, it's not going to replace you, but you are, I'm sure, encouraging people to use AI smartly in their jobs to do it better and faster, right? So what's your take on that?
So I guess I'll just back up. When the first sort of large language model, you know, ChatGPT came rolling out, everybody was like, what the hell is this? And we scrambled to figure out what ethically we should be thinking about it, you know, and we did this big missive. I had it published in like PR Daily. And it really kind of holds true, which is that there should be some guardrails around what you do, how you do it. You don't want to have it, you don't want to pass off sort of AI as original human thinking, you know, that kind of thing. Where we've gotten to is very much a hybrid role, where we have like a dedicated AI Slack channel, for example, where we share everything we can possibly learn about AI. Is there a new tool? Who's going to evaluate it? Is there something we should be demoing? Demo that. And we've brought into the fold a handful of these tools that we use. Now, the one thing that I think is always going to be a constant is that human writing will be front and center of Crackle, like no matter what. Will we use AI to help with ideation? Sure. Will it help us with some skeletons of, you know, a writing project? 100%. There are definite use cases for it where it makes a lot of sense. And there are certain prompts that help a hell of a lot with like researching a podcast guest that might come on.
Totally.
A show.
Totally.
You know, like there's a bunch of these things.
Trends, that yeah.
There's a whole lot of things that we should use. And research, for example, you know, this is my like brain tweaking going back to your earlier thought. So we talked earlier about like tracking hours and all that stuff. And that was like how we came up, tracking hours, 15 minute increments, blah, blah, blah. Well, how are you going to defend the hourly billing model for communications, for PR, when an intern can do in 20 seconds what used to take 20 hours in terms of research? You're still going to build hourly? Like, what are the Edelmans of the world going to do? How are you going to bill hourly when there's AI doing all this work?
Back to the neurodiversity thing, as an ADHD person, I cannot do hourly whatever, because I can do 3 weeks of work in 5 hours sometimes, and I can just sit around and smash my head against a wall for 5 days being anxious about something and getting nothing done. So, you know.
So anyway, that was a tangent, but I mean, holy shit, right? Like, and the hourly agency model is so screwed, screwed, because AI is going to be more pronounced, not less. And you can't tell me there aren't smart CMOs thinking like, how are you charging me 500 hours of research in the month of July for stuff that I could do myself in like 2 hours? So anyway, that model is going to be screwed. It's got to be a value-based model. So anyway, just to finish with AI, I think that there's a lot of efficacy. It worries me a lot that there are people who are pinning their hopes and dreams on writing for AI, because I think they're going to be really disappointed. And I think that the pitching process relative to media relations cannot be AI driven, at least not yet. Like, maybe in a couple of years, it'll be so good and so compelling and so convincing that real human beings will read it and say like, yes, that's a great pitch.
I mean, the pitching process has already really changed. That's one of the things I want to hear your perspective on. And I don't know, we probably have time to go over it today, but what, like, that is a whole different game. Where does that come from? I didn't do that one.
I'm not doing that either, by the way.
I know.
I'm not trying to discourage your question.
There's a ghost. And it distracted me. What was I talking about?
The pitching process.
Pitching process. What does that look like right now?
Yeah. It's less is more is what it means. Yeah. So when I started out, you know, yes, we do phone calls all day. That was great. But when we did written pitches, it was like this, you know, how can I sound like I'm standing atop Mount Olympus with flowing robes to compel these top tier journalists to, you know, to read this? And now it's much more about being finite and really concrete and adding just the facts to what you've got. So it's data rich.
Yes.
If you've got data, you lead with data, you know? So like, you do the research, whether you have AI do the research or you do the research yourself. It's like the last 10, 15 articles that reporter has written, you make sure you know exactly what the hell they've covered. And then you try to tap into the vein of what they cover by offering fresh, valuable data and insights to what they typically cover. So that's the easiest path in right now, is provide rock solid data with the receipts to either support or rebut what they have been already covering. And that's the gold right now. So it's you don't go cast a huge net. You pick the top, you know, 20 folks that would likely care at the target publications that your audience would care about as well. And then you just add value all damn day. You cut out the flowery nonsense. You don't have a delayed lead. You don't waste anybody's time. You just get right to the goddamn point with the data. That's how you do it.
It's the same with creating content on social media, isn't it? Right? Like, I mean, just, it's like you got to get, it's the hook, and then you get to the point and add value and move on with your life. I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. Although I think there's a little more license on like LinkedIn to be creative and like a little wacky from time to time. Like I write about serious topics, but I also like to get whimsical occasionally and lead people down a journey they think they're going on, and then like cliffhanger, and then just switch it up on them at the very end. So I'll play around with people, and that's fun too, and they tend to appreciate it because they know my writing well enough that it surprises them. And anytime you can elicit a genuine surprise that this is not where I thought that was headed, then that tends to be fun and create a lot of engagement too.
Well, also, I don't know how it's possible, but I've gotten all of my best media hits because of people, journalists finding my content on LinkedIn, right? So it kind of, you know.
Yeah. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, yeah. PR Daily, PR
put
Week.
Put your stuff out there, right? Like, they'll find you. Like, it goes back to what you said. Like, unlock your brain. It doesn't have to be in some, you don't have to have a keynote stage to do it, right? You just have to, like, have a computer and the will to want to show up and do it and engage with the people who engage with you. And really, like, you can build a platform if you want. Anyone could build a platform if they want to put in the time to do it. Yeah, and I think that's
you can be an expert in Himalayan macrame and you will find an audience on LinkedIn. You post what you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I did not mean to interrupt you. The fact that we can talk to 10,000 people in a day. Like, where else can you do that, right? Like,
yeah, well, in your case, in my case, 60,000 or whatever it is a day.
Yeah. It's
bananas. Now, I don't want to get into this LinkedIn thing too much because there are so many things. We can have a whole separate show, and I'm sure we will, just about LinkedIn and about personal brand and all that. But boy, that algorithm's all wacky right now, isn't it? Jesus.
I mean, it's funny. I've been complaining that I haven't had any posts that have been taking off. And then I had one today that's like at like 550,000 views. But then the rest of my posts are all way, way down as far as impressions. It's fascinating. Nobody's ever going to understand the LinkedIn algorithm. And we have to just keep showing up, feeding it. Just keep feeding it and keep it happy.
The beast. Well, the cool thing is video is all the rage right now. And I get why they're trying to do it. I don't love doing video that much. We've talked about this, but I like the fact that we're doing video right now.
Yes.
Ta-da! So we got some video that we can share with people, which is going to be exciting and easy. And it feels more authentic than me trying to like part two ferns and be like amusing. You know what I mean?
I feel like we need some ferns if we're really going to make this official. I was going to kind of make you answer the question of why you wanted to do a podcast, because you had been putting it off for so long. So what finally kicked you in the butt to do it? Was it the LinkedIn algorithm? Did it finally get you?
So I will tell you that I've been asked to start a podcast probably 25 times in the last 2 years. And I've been flattered every time, but I never felt that I knew why. Like, in other words, I never felt like I would. So what am I going to do? Talk about PR, just drone on and say the same thing that I say basically on LinkedIn. So that was the first thing. The second thing was video started coming around like, I need to start doing video now. Like, what am I going to do? Podcasting was like, oh, that's one way to do it. But that still wasn't enough to compel me to get over the line. It was really because I realized I had a sufficient enough audience now that I could potentially reach them in a new way. But I didn't feel I had the right sort of partner to do it with. I didn't want it to be just me. I didn't want to, you know, command the whole thing and just like have it be the Perry show. I was looking, if I was going to do it, to find the right partner, honestly. And this is not like to, you know.
Yeah, to my horn is fun.
Butter you up. But I've been reading and following you just as much as you've been reading and following me in the past year. And I've just felt a very kinetic, kindred sort of like, wow, I bet we'd interplay well together. I bet that we would have fun in the sandbox together if we should throw down. And then I think you alluded to it in one of my posts, like a podcast. And I was like, hey, we kind of joked and toyed with it. And then it just seemed like the fates aligned, really, you know. And I this is our first podcast, but I'm more convinced than ever that this is the right decision. And I was telling my wife last night, I was like, I think I was born to do a podcast.
You've been putting it out all this time. But it's what you're born to do.
I have arrived, everybody.
Amazing. Amazing. I feel like that's like the best way to end our first podcast. But I will say I am super excited because it's going to be the most ADHD, unfiltered, no Fs given, whatever we feel like talking about. But if you guys have ideas, let us know because, you know, we're here for it.
Yeah, it will not be boring. And yeah, we're going to start booking guests. And so if you think that might be you, feel free to DM either one of us. But we're going to have a pretty, I think, diverse roster of people that are going to start coming on. And our schedule is TBD. We're going to figure out kind of what works for us and get into a groove. But this is pretty fantastic. I've had a good time. Good first pod, my friend.
Absolutely. Hopefully we'll be back for round two soon.
Under embargo. Woo!